Access number 29039, Mr. Alan Pollock, Reel 15. Now, you were saying about John Grundy, or John Grundy.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very subjective, but he just seemed in some ways like a slight breath of fresh air, but purely in terms of the depth of involvement. And I got the idea that he might not have had a sort of Rolls-Royce brain, but as a commander, he projected a degree of confidence, I think, and in terms of delegating a degree of independence. But that was very much of a first impression, and that he had seemed natural at the command front. He had commanded 249 Squadron during the war, and in fact that was a strange link later with Nicholson and Tangmere and Nicholson's widow. But that was a pure coincidence that I got involved with that now, with that later.
So you were there for a year, so that, what, was that September?
Well, just over, yeah. It was more than that. It was a year, it turned out to be a year and 4 months, I think, from memory. Something like that, because it was early, it was February or so, I think. I'm sorry, I haven't got the sheet of... Sorry, 1st of September 1959.
Till when?
I was down at headquarters RAF Germany until the 12th of March 1961.
Now, what was your next posting going to be?
Can I just, before I talk about the next posting, just mention Paddy Crisham, who was... Paddy Crisham was the AOC RAF Germany...
Air Officer Commanding,
yeah, and
so
he effectively.
Was an air marshal, was he?
That's right, and
what was he like?
No, he was a splendid bloke. Although I'd got no responsibility to start with. Brian Gubbins was his ADC, and he handed over Brian Gubbins, handed over to somebody I knew quite well. I knew both. Well, Brian I'd known at school, and John Merry, who took over, had also been on 26 Squadron, so. There we were, both from 26, strangely, with John Merry taking over.
But what about after. Crisham?
Paddy Crisham, intriguingly, had been more senior at an earlier stage in the war and beyond to EJ. But they did get on well together. And Paddy Crisham, I thought, was a really splendid bloke. I like them both, but I mean different personalities. But what I didn't mention on the plus side about the tour was, rightly or wrongly, I sidled up, if that's the right word, to somebody that seemed a soft target, who I knew commanded one of the javelin squadrons at Bruggen, and rather said. Stretching the truth to beyond the elastic, I said the CNC would much appreciate if I could be checked out on the javelin, and very quickly I was able to organise that and be checked out on 87 Squadron to fly the javelin, and that was really a great privilege, because I don't know of anybody else that didn't go through the whole 6 week Leeming course or longer.
So what did you think of the javelin?
Well, again, I didn't do that much flying, but I was checked out on it, and my big impression then was the slightly negative aspect of very elderly third tour, seemingly average navigators that were flying with it. But the javelin did have this problem of the centerline closure, and that the navigators had to be fairly switched on, because there was this problem of the navigator having to get out pretty quickly if something went wrong. But it did appear to me that there was almost like a trade union of these elderly navigators about how the aircraft were flown. But again, this is just a very fresh image that I got. And the reason I'm saying it is that later I was so impressed, and this is one after I'd left the Air Force, with the development of the new fast jet approach navigators that came in beyond onto the Phantom and the Tornado era. And the Air Force somehow got that right, because my idea was that the navigators in the not just 87 squadron but elsewhere, many of them had, as I say, were second, third, even fourth tour, quite old guys, and that in a way that affected largely the way the squadrons ran. And it was splendid that somehow the Air Force, because I thought there were going to be big problems with the new aircraft, and somehow the Air Force really got that right. You know, they gave them a lot of low-level flying when they started the navigators, because many of the navigators were pilots that hadn't got their wings. You know, had failed on their flying training. Not all of them, but that side of the Air Force, I mean, to this day. And of course it's changing now with the Typhoon coming in, the Eurofighter, which is going back to the single-seater. But in many ways, I think the navigators that we had on the Buccaneer Force and the Phantom Force and the Tornadoes in both roles, you know, the mud-moving ones and the, you know, the strike mud-movers and the air defence F3s were... Some of those weapons systems officers, very bright blokes and extremely good. And all I'm saying is that aspect, I think, worked extremely well.
Now, back then, so what was your next posting going to be in March? Then?
Well, it was... I was due to be on 208 squadron, 208 course, sorry, at Central Flying School. In other words, 8 courses later, which is neatly shows that it must have been virtually, yeah, not quite 2 years, wasn't it? That's right. So it was, I went to Central Flying School in May 1961, but in between I'd been to Royal Air Force Manby, and Manby was, that was for what was called a refresher course, because rightly or wrongly,
Yeah, right, but let's do Manby first then. So you went to Manby, that was your next place.
Yeah, Manby was just a refresher flying, because although I'd done a lot of, I'd been fortunate really to maximise, because of contacts and still being in Germany, to do a high amount of flying.
And what was at Manby?
Manby was the the refresher flying, and next to Manby was Strubby, where they had meteors, but at Manby, I was really there to do refresher flying in the Piston Provost, because that's what they had there. And refresher flying was for both people coming off ground jobs like myself, and sometimes senior officers to keep their hands in before they were going to predominantly non-flying, but just to get them flying experience again. And at Manby, I was only there between the 20th of March 1961 and 7th of May. So in other words, it was whatever that is, about 6 weeks, isn't it? But Manby, very pleasant area up in Lincolnshire, up in the Wolds, very close to Nelson's birthplace.
And it
up
wasn't
there.
A flying school or anything, it was just a base?
No, flying school.
Which one?
It was just... It didn't have a number. I'm pretty certain RF Manby didn't. I think it was called Refresher Flying.
Okay, no, that's
something like that.
So you were there, what, just a month to April?
Yes, and there was the first time I remember I met Ray Hanna, because he was at Strubby on the meteors there, because there weren't very many meteors, and that was where Ray, who sadly died recently, as you know, a year ago, met his Wren wife.
Now, what? Anything about the course, or was it just?
No, that was very good, because I mean I like the Piston Provost was excellent trainer, and in many ways it should have lasted much longer. But of course the through jet thing had come in almost already by then. And I arrive at Central Flying School with 208 course.
Now, where is Central Flying School?
Well, that's at Little Rissington, which is, or was then, and it was there between 1946 and 1976. And as you know, we've sort of just completed the book on that. But we were spot on, or my course, 208, was spot in the middle of that. So, and it was the summer of 1961. And so it was literally just before the Berlin Wall went up. And all that was happening with, in John Grandy's time, at the headquarters where I'd left that summer. But it was a splendid time to do the course. It was very good weather, and again, the Central Flying School course was really, first of all, to teach you to be very accurate on your flying, you know, because if you were instructing, you had to be able to do everything yourself pretty well first. And I thought the staff were good there.
How do they improve the accuracy of your flying? I mean, what's the method of doing it? Is it just to comment on what you're doing or what?
Yeah, to some extent on flying fighters, you're given a degree of independence, and obviously they're all single-seaters. And although there are people responsible, and there are ex-QFIs on the squadron normally, one or two, sometimes there even could be three on a squadron who'd been instructors and before. But generally, you were learning for yourself at a fairly high rate on a fighter squadron. It was going back to almost everything you'd done when you'd learned to fly, but doing everything as accurately and as well as possible in terms of being able to join, land, take off, overshoot, climb up, and be sort of generally alert. The airmanship, lookout was everything to, in a way, both there and later, to teach students, you know, that the one thing all the time they had to be very careful was lookout, and also their instrument and airmanship, keeping an eye on what was happening in there as far as the engine side was concerned of the flying aspect. And also, there were about 20 plus exercises.
What
which
type of thing?
You were divided out, and you would normally almost do one of these after you'd got to know the aircraft, because I hadn't flown the Jet Provost before.
This
was
a
Jet Provost Mark III. Excuse me. And the Mark III was the underpowered one. Quite quickly, the JP4 came in, the Jet Provost 4. And by the time I was actually doing the instruction job, within a few months, the Jet Provost 4s came to where I subsequently went to, which was Cranwell. But intriguingly, the 4s did not last as long as the 3s, rather counterintuitively, because the 4s had the bigger engine, and you had a third more power from memory and thrust, and they went up more, but they were more heavily used, inevitably, for aerobatics. And looking back in the longer term, the Jet Provost Mark IV, with a more powerful engine, ended up doing less flying than the Jet Provost IIIs, because it was to do with the in practice they had far harsher use in terms of aerobatic use, and for that reason they didn't last as long term as the IIIs in terms of the amount of flying they did. I've described that correctly. It was just harsher flying led to more fatigue to a lesser life in Air Force usage.
Now, what were these exercises like, this program of exercises you had to go through?
Well, you would normally, quite regularly, the whole thing really was to do with, once you'd learned the aircraft, it was split up. You basically had ground school and flying, and the split was something like a morning in the ground school and then flying that afternoon and then flying the following morning. So you'd do that sort of rotation of split to start with, and the ground school was pretty important, and most people found it fairly demanding as well.
So what we'll leave the flying exercise. What were you doing?
No, the ground school really ran in tandem, and then you had two sets of exams really. And on the ground school side, it was everything in terms of airmanship, the type of aircraft you had to know, everything and anything to do with the jet provost, and then you had aerodynamics that you had to learn. A lot about aerodynamics, and also engines you had to know so that you actually could not only learn it but teach it as well. A bit on instructional technique, you had to give lectures there, which you were marked on, and you had to do a lot of, obviously, to do with meteorology was one of the topics there. And You had to pass I think, a reasonably high standard for your academic knowledge of almost anything and everything to do with flying, really.
So now the flying exercises, that's the...
On the flying exercises, yes. Really what you were learning to do, and this went right back to Smith Barry and the First World War and the Gosport system, which he developed. Smith Barry realized that when he was commanding a squadron, that many of the people were arriving under instructed, and developed this scheme which spread really almost round the world, but the Royal Air Force got the first benefit from, or the Royal Flying Corps. And that Gosport system was really showing people, by virtue of fairly standardized what we call patter, P-A-T-T-E-R, you know, to patter, and it was really to take someone through while you were flying it, flying the aircraft at the same time, and describing what was going on in a reasonably academic way, but as interestingly as possible, so that the student got a good idea. And the one almost invariably, that was one of the most important ones, was the very first essentials of, called effects of controls, where you started with a brand new student, and that was amazingly one of the most difficult ones and demanding ones to do, where literally you just went up and flew straight and level and described the position of the nose on the horizon in front of you, and as you accelerated, the nose would obviously be slightly lower, and at lower speed the nose would be higher, and then from that basic turning both ways, and then steep turning, and then max rate turning, and steep descents, max rate descents, and things like that. And you'd have to be able to demonstrate the thing well at the same time as talking, and that was the patter. And there were some people who were very good, pretty good, and even very good at the flying, that couldn't chatter at the same time, and I'm afraid in a way I felt like a lot of people, not many people wanted to go to Central Flying School, and the intriguing thing was that successive commandants have written about this, that often when people turned up and said they wanted to go there, they sometimes wouldn't have them, because some of them, it was to stay in England, and it was because they were married and X, Y, and Z, that they thought that this would be a good thing to go into instruction. But often it was the ones that turned up that said, "Oh, I don't want to go," that they really were after, because often they were the guys that wanted to stay in the fighter squadrons. And I think then, because other people noticed this later, that later the ethos of instruction did alter, but in those days, the vast majority, three quarters, I'd have thought, of the instructors at Central Flying School and elsewhere in the command had been on fighter squadrons, because there were a lot of fighter squadrons then, and they did have a slightly different, more press-on attitude to the whole thing. And the little side heading that I put, which I think I still believe to this day, was Central Flying School was all right, provided you didn't inhale, because some people did inevitably. Some people spent a lifetime in Central Flying School, in Flying Training Command, rather, and that could happen and did happen. And that was the worry about some people, that they'd end up trapped in an instructional system and they didn't get back to the front line again. But what I haven't mentioned, of course, was that Little Rissington was in the Cotswolds, and it was a really lovely, lovely area there. I mean, the Cotswolds, it's very close to Boughton on the Water. It's just, if you, Boughton on the Water's one of the more famous little towns in the Cotswolds, and you just climbed up really to what was 750 feet, occasionally it's 720 feet, and it was the highest operational airfield operated by the Royal Air Force in England. And it did have some very special weather, and you did have some real lousy weather there at times. The fog sometimes would slowly come up and envelop the field, and also in the winter. And I remember when I went back later, how harsh the winters were there, because you could have some pretty harsh winters.
Yeah. Anything else about the course? How long did it last for?
Well, I can see here that I went on 8th of May 1961, and I finished on the 31st of August 61, a date which I remembered very well. Well, halfway through, you'd have your intermediate handling test. And then towards the end of the course, there were various trophies and sort of prize awards for people. But I think the one that most of the ex-fighter people were interested in was the Clarkson Trophy, which was for low-level aerobatics. And one very good thing about Central Flying School was it then encouraged, and to this day, that those that wanted to could under a degree of tuition by people already there that were instructors that could do low-level aerobatics, it was encouraged. It's something that I think the Royal Air Force has got good value out of. You can say that we lost a few pilots doing it, but the other way around, it was an interesting exercise to be able to do. And that was, we're talking initially about Singleton Aerobatics, but they also obviously had their formation teams. And my basic training there, the first basic side, because we really did a basic and then either an advanced or applied, it sort of changed its name. And on the applied side, you were doing more advanced exercises, the low-level navigation the more advanced exercises and running through things at a higher level. But to start with, Snowy McKee was my instructor, an ex-Kiwi guy who was actually then all that year leading the Pelicans, which was the formation team, but also on the second part of the course, rather, I had a different instructor. And then if you wanted to, and I was able to get ahead and get my final handling test out of the way early to practice low-level aerobatics.
This for the
and
trophy.
That was for the trophy, yeah.
So how did it go?
Well, my last it was rather strange, really, because there were, I think, four of us pre-qualified for the fly-off on the last day. And unfortunately, the ground crew had ended up, as sometimes happens, with aircraft with different fuel states on them, or in the aircraft, and we actually had to draw straws, literally, for the choice we had. And we felt that we gave the best aircraft to the youngest guy, who'd come off training. I think he was a creamed off QFI from memory. And the other three, one was an ex-Canberra bloke, Brian Stead, and one was Peter Jennings, who I liked a lot and got on well with, and had been in a certain degree of trouble with as well. But and myself, and I had the last choice of the aircraft, and sadly mine had got the tip tanks on the ends all full of fuel, but I felt if I got off early enough, I could burn it off. But I had a dreadful trouble burning off, because you had to arrive and do your display at a set time and a set minutes, really. And in a way, they forgot about this problem, obviously, afterwards. And between myself and Peter, we'd all flown with each other before. And when I was up with Peter, you know, I was experimenting with this. The idea I had, to be slightly different, was to actually come in completely silently with the aircraft flamed out. But you needed a light aircraft for that. And sadly, you know, when I went off, there I was with an aircraft that you weren't really supposed to do high G manoeuvres in, overloaded, roaring around with my air brake out and full throttle trying to get down to a light weight, and then realising as the time approached that I just would not be able to do the show which I'd practiced, which was rather sad. And rightly or wrongly, on the spur of the moment, I thought, well, what I hadn't described was I'd won the thing the previous day on the marks, but told that on all my textbook manoeuvres were all right, but I was told that I had to do something a little more special, and in terms of getting a bit more pizzazz in the voluntary side. And this was at the back of my head, and rightly or wrongly, when I couldn't do this arrival with the flamed out engine, because it was far too heavy to do that, and also there was tremendous popping noise if you had the donk out, if you had the engine flamed out. And in that situation, I ended up just coming up inverted from the bottom of the hill. And at the top of the hill, what was intriguing, and I mean, I'd never learned this, because it wasn't the sort of thing you would learn, that at the top of the hill, obviously, being inverted, I actually had to pull down round the top of the hill, because it literally was the top of a hill like that. And of course, from the ground, you weren't really supposed to be that low. So there was a bit too much pizzazz, because as soon as I literally got the right way up again, and that was perfectly, I did that perfectly safely, and in the tower, the station commander really, really did his nut on the RT, and because I'd come off a ground job, I mean, I regretted ever afterwards not just pulling out my RT lead, because occasionally, that I'm afraid we, you know, that was something that one did, and I really should have gone on to do my whole display then, and taken the stick afterwards. But at the top, I just did a reverse roll off the top, and I mean, from the ground, they because they then could see that I had to stop, because I mean, he stopped my show, and I was disqualified almost before I started. But to be fair to him, and that was rather forgotten about, was the at 2 o'clock that night, that day, they'd had a double bailout from a double ejection, and in fact Snowy McKee, it was my basic instructor that was that they had to get out at night. So maybe one ought to be a bit more forgiving about the hierarchy. But and then that evening, because I'd been disqualified, and my friend Peter Jennings won it, which was fine, and just walking back to the mess that After that flight, I noticed that there was a new tower going up there, and there was a lot of quick setting cement. And that evening, you know, because each course used to do something or other, and I had the bright idea, and it very quickly spread to the others, that we would brick the ground school up. And we set about, and we had a diversion tactics in the bar, and we actually did have right up to chest height the ground school bricked up. And then at 2 a.m, sadly, the some of the racket was heard, and the station duty officer came down. And we'd also had problem with a rather drunk Canadian, a super Canadian on our course, that didn't like the way we'd done it and took down 4 or 5 layers of bricks to do them a bit more professionally. But sadly, you know, at 2 a.m, so very closely, that final day, I was almost thrown out on both the flying side and on the ground side for what we'd done to the ground school.